Wisconsin State Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsham Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right. Please be seated. Good morning. We are here for a rule petition this morning. The rule is 24.05 in the matter of the amendment of Supreme Court Rule 13045. So far for presenters, I have initially Judge Sankovitz. Then I have seven presenters. I'm assuming you've had a chance to see if your name is on the list, if you're wishing to present. So if we get through all the presenters and there's someone else in the audience that feels that they want to say something or present something or feel that something was missed, I will open the opportunity for you to come forward and make your remarks as well. So it's not like this is the end and it can never change, but this is what we're starting with today, and we'll see where we go. With that, Judge Sankovitz.
Good morning. So nice to be with you this morning. May it please the court. As we look back over 20 years of the success that we've had with public interest assessment, we should acknowledge the leadership of two of our colleagues who helped make this happen. We honor John Skilton. He stood there at this podium 20 years ago and advocated on behalf of the petitioner at the time, Wistaff. He's one of the most esteemed lawyers who ever stood at this podium and a passionate advocate for justice. And in his remarks, he pointed to the words that are chiseled above the door of almost every courthouse in the state: equal justice under law. He told the court, words are not a voluntary proposition. Those words are not just a hopeful expression. Those words are a command, an obligation. He said that they were the alpha and omega of responsibilities that lawyers take on in exchange for the privilege, for the exclusive privilege of being allowed to practice law in this state. We need to honor one of your colleagues as well, one of your colleagues on the bench, made an instrumental decision back 20 years ago. And I'm referring to our former Chief Justice, Pat Rogenczak, who was the one in the administrative conference who made the motion to approve the PILSIF assessment. And more importantly, she articulated the primary reason why lawyers should be required, as part of the price of the admission to practice law, to contribute to a fund to help people who can't afford lawyers. As she framed the question for the court, she said, if the court and lawyers show their commitment to supporting civil legal services, that makes a stronger case for all of us to go to the legislature, to get the legislature to make the investment that this problem needs. Justice Rogenczak said to her colleagues that the lack of adequate funding for civil legal services, words, is an issue crying out for leadership by the court. The court answered that leadership cry 20 years ago, which brings me to our petition today. If you'd asked those leaders 20 years ago, is this a one-time fix? Is that $50 locked in forever? What do you think they would have said? Well, here we are, 20 years later. That $50 pledge lawyers make in support of those who can't afford lawyers now feels like $30, right? Every budget cycle, I and many of these people go knock on doors over in the legislature and appear before Joint Finance and make our pitch to the legislature to make the investment that almost every state in the nation makes other than Wisconsin. And every time we approach the legislature, we're met with a question. Why is this our problem? Isn't this a lawyer problem? Isn't this the court's problem? What are lawyers and courts doing to solve the problem? And every year we tell them the problem of access to justice is not just a court problem. It is not just a lawyer problem. It is a problem for more than a half a million families and households and individuals in Wisconsin. It's a problem for constituents of those legislators. And every year we can chronicle the many, many contributions that we as courts and as lawyers have made to try to solve that problem, including, and we always point it out, a regulation which requires every lawyer in the state to contribute to a fund to help provide lawyers to those who can't afford them. And we tell the legislatures, no matter how much time and effort courts and lawyers invest in solving this problem, the sheer scale of the problem requires an investment by the legislator, which is the case in every state in the nation, and some legislatures have responded. Minnesota, our neighbor, $33 million every year appropriated for civil legal services. Illinois, $4 million appropriated every year for civil legal services on top of the $7 million that is raised in Illinois by the mandatory fee, the mandatory assessment on lawyers, $2.5 million in Iowa. So it's 2025. It's another budget cycle. I and my colleagues here are preparing our pitch, and it's all set, except that that $50 pledge that we like to highlight now kind of feels like a $30 pledge, right? So that's where the court can make a difference today. Make a difference to keeping our commitment to those words that John Skilton highlighted for us, equal justice under law. I'll keep my remaining remarks short. Happy to answer questions that you have. I'd like to reserve some time to respond to anybody who might oppose the petition. I think there's three questions that need to be framed, at least framed by those who oppose the petition. First of all, why shouldn't the legislature solve this problem rather than the court? And I think I've addressed that already, but I'm happy to elaborate. Secondly, isn't 50 bucks a lot to force a lawyer to pay on top of the bar dues that lawyers complain about so much? And I'm happy to address that question as well. And finally, does this court even have the power to impose this assessment? In other words, is this an unconstitutional tax imposed by the third branch on people in the state? We addressed that in our papers. It was addressed 20 years ago. That argument was rejected by the court then, but I'm happy to address it again if that would be helpful too. I'll preview for you the comments that you're going to hear from others today. You're going to hear from Judge Domina, who will tell you about the difference that access to justice makes in the courts when people are provided with lawyers. You're going to hear from civil legal service providers who show you the difference it makes to connect needy families, veterans, elders, victims of domestic violence, and others to the services of a lawyer in order to get the services they need for their family. And you're going to hear from a couple of new lawyers, the perspective of the next generation, who are committed to this movement. And I think their commitment is going to inspire you. I think it'll help you find the optimism you need to make the next step, to make the landmark decision today in the name of access to justice. With that, then, I'm happy to answer questions. I'm also happy to turn it over to the other speakers who are here today.
I'm curious if you have what you think the limits to our constitutional powers are. I, to be frank, am sympathetic to the idea that this is an unconstitutional tax on attorneys that we don't have the power to make. And I'm wondering what you think the limits would be to us taking money from attorneys and doing it to accomplish other social goods or things that we believe are generally in the interest of the improvement of justice. I'm not, of course, doubting the importance of the importance of attorneys and the difference they can make in the lives of those who have difficulty securing their rights, those sorts of things, and addressing their disputes. But I am troubled by the idea that we have administrative and superintending authority, and there has to be some limits to that. What do you think they are?
And the limits of one branch on a power that seems to belong only to another branch, the power of the legislature to raise revenue, right?
Right.
Yeah. So two quick answers, and then I'll go into more detail if it's helpful. First of all, the limits on the court's power are set forth in State versus Jackman. That's the 1973 case that is discussed in the briefs that have been filed. That's the case in which the court held that a boat license is something fee for that boat license is something that the first branch, the executive branch, could impose on people who wanted to use boats in Wisconsin, even though it raised revenue that exceeded what it cost just to put numbers on the fronts of boats. That fee raised money to provide for a boat safety program. And the court found that that was within the power of a branch of government to impose as part of a regulatory fee. This branch of government owns the same power. Secondly, this concern that you articulate, Justice Hagedorn, was the very same concern that Justice Prosser raised and articulated in the hearing when this petition was first approved, when this assessment was first approved. He asked the question, well, do we have unlimited power? Could we raise money to pay for indigent criminal defense? He gave another example. He said, could we raise money to provide relief for victims of disasters? Now, that example he rose seems a lot more acute today than it did 20 years ago, but we have to remember that the hearing 20 years ago was in January of 2025 on the heels of that awful tsunami on Boxing Day in 2024. And he gave us an example of, could we as a third branch raise money to provide disaster relief? And in his decision, he expressed a concern about whether or not there was any logical stopping point to the authority of the court to raise funds through a regulatory fee like this. His view did not persuade most of the court. Five justices went the other way, including Justice Rogensack. But I think the answer to his question and the answer to your question goes back to Jackman. As long as the regulatory fee is reasonably related to a legitimate regulatory purpose, then the court has the authority to impose it. And whether we're on some slippery slope or we're going to try to stretch that concept, reasonable relationship, as far as we can to step out of our lane and do the work of the legislature, I think we count on the wisdom of this court. 20 years has passed since the Pilsip Amendment was adopted, or Pilsip Assessment was adopted. It's never been used as a precedent for this court to raise money for anything else.
Yeah, I hear that, but I take the answer to your question to be, well, we could do quite a bit, actually, but hopefully we won't. Maybe that's the answer, that we'll be wise enough not to, but it sounds
like... Maybe even we would say, as long as we are reasonable.
Sure, but you could come up with all sorts of things that'd be reasonable. I mean, we could take money from attorneys and fund, you know, scholarships at law schools that could promote justice. We could take money and raise it and to do initiatives to recruit, you know, underrepresented attorneys in certain areas, or all sorts of different things, mandate, you know, XYZ. It's pretty broad, and I do think when you're talking about our constitutional authority to regulate the profession, that at the very least this sort of request is on the margins of that. I think we should be careful. If you look at the development of sort of the authority we've taken to ourselves, it has gotten broader and broader and broader, and perhaps we may want to be mindful of continuing to take more power to ourselves, because these things do take on a life of their own. There are very few taxes that go away, and it's also notable that this hasn't gone away. It's notable also as well that this didn't work in getting the legislature to fund these things, and so I'm curious. If part of the strategy was, let's start the ball rolling down this important and critical area, it doesn't sound like that our action in this way helped solve that problem.
Well, it didn't immediately. That's true. It did make a difference, we hope. It was a difference that was made in the one biennium where the legislature did provide $2.5 million of funding in the 2009-2010 biennium. We've been turned down lots of times since. We feel like we're on one of those apps that the sergeant was telling us not to consult during this hearing, where people keep swiping left on us. That hurts, and that can create pessimism. But I think there's reasons why the court should be optimistic and not pessimistic about the difference you can make today if you approve this improvement that we're looking for. Here's five reasons why I think you should be optimistic. First of all, when we go to the legislature with this amount of money, we're going to be telling the legislature that the court not only stepped up once, but has stepped up again right now. This argument that this is a lawyer problem or a court problem is met with concrete action. Yes, we are doing our part. And that gives us the ability to tell the legislature, look at what's being done with other states. We're doing our part. Now it's your part.
Can I just respond to that quickly?
Sure.
Because I want to hear your other points. But it strikes me as just as likely the legislature will respond the other way. Okay, good. This is the court's problem. You go ahead and solve it. You know, if the legislature sees somebody else doing something, they're not going to all of a sudden say, great, let's also spend money too, particularly money that, you know, isn't going to be on anybody's, you know, running a commercial on, right? That sort of thing. So it seems to me that the more we head down this path, the less and less likely the legislature will feel any pressing need to weigh into it. And so we might actually be hurting the cause of legislative action on this.
And if we imposed a $1,000 fee as part of the privilege to practice law in the state, maybe a legislature could say that. A legislator could say that with a straight face. But $100 from 19,000, 16,000 lawyers is not going to have that effect on the legislators. I think they will still see that the ball's in their court. And one thing that's going to show the legislators that the ball's in their court is that their constituents can see what their friends and neighbors and relatives and the people they know about right across the border are getting the kind of help that they're not getting in Wisconsin, that they're being ignored in Wisconsin. They get help in Michigan and in Iowa and in Minnesota and in Illinois, the kind of help that people are denied in Wisconsin because legislature won't fund anything. That makes a difference as well. Here's another thing I think makes a difference and gives me some optimism. Last year, WISTAF commissioned a cost-benefit study. The cost-benefit study shows that for every dollar that's invested in civil legal services in Wisconsin, there's a return of $8, eightfold return to the Wisconsin economy. And a lot of that is made up of federal benefits that can only be accessed with the help of a lawyer, money that we're letting go back to the U.S. Treasury rather than being used here in Wisconsin. And the difference is, do people have the lawyers they need to navigate that thicket of regulations to get the help that they need? The cost-benefit study is written in a language that the legislature can understand, and I think that that will add to the persuasive effect of the argument we will make. I think what will also add to it is up in the ante. We are putting more money on the table ourselves, and I think that that appeals to this reciprocal instinct that all of us as humans have. I spend all my days mediating these days. I don't get to spend as much time in the courtroom. But what I see every day in mediation is when one party makes an offer that shows that they're willing to do their part, almost every single time, unless you're dealing with a psychopath on the other side, people feel that natural human instinct to reciprocate. I don't think the legislature is full of psychopaths. I think they are full of people just like
I don't know.
Those comments will not be recorded.
That was your out loud voice.
but unlike other states, this isn't optional. It isn't the lawyers in the bar stepping up and saying, here, we're doing this. It's seven people imposing a tax.
Yes,
on
there
the
are
lawyers.
Five other states.
I'm sorry?
There are five other states.
My problem is, I think, what Justice Hagedorn has been expressing, what are the limits? If we can do this, we could raise money for anything. There's all kinds, I don't need to tell this audience all of the funding issues that exist throughout our justice system in Wisconsin. Are we going to start taxing attorneys to pay for courthouse improvements, to pay for raises for court interpreters because we can't get enough interpreters into the court system? There is no stopping point, and I appreciate everything that that is being done to improve access to justice in the civil realm. I grew up, my family needed civil legal services, and we couldn't afford them, so we went without. So I appreciate the need. I fully understand. But for me, the biggest issue is the power and the authority of this court, and we have to be very careful about exercising our power and our authority, because if we tread into areas where we don't belong, then again, we sit here, there's no check on this court, what we do. And we have to be fiscally responsible and good stewards of people's money. And it's easy for us to say, oh, sure, let's tack on another cost. another tax for the privilege of practicing law in Wisconsin. But if we don't have the authority to do that, it opens up the door and sets a precedent for us to do all kinds of things that are not constitutional. So that's my issue.
Could I address that briefly?
Please.
Sure. What we're talking about is the slippery slope. We start down this path, we can't stop ourselves. We're acting in an administrative capacity here. We're not creating a precedent for lawyers to use against courts or for lawyers to use against other lawyers or for municipalities to use against their citizens or the legislature to use. We're setting a precedent for this court to use in the future.
That's what scares me.
Okay. Well, here's some reassurance. That precedent was set 20 years ago. 20 years. Not only has no further assessment been imposed, I don't think any further assessment has been proposed. Nobody has said, despite all of the issues that Justice Bradley raises, interpreter funding, funding for new courtrooms, funding for courtroom security, despite all of these pressing issues, nobody said, you know what, let's assess the lawyers. We could. It is reasonably related to the practice of law, and lawyers and their clients would benefit. But the court doesn't. The slope is not that slippery. And I think you could set a precedent today that says we're doing this on a very limited basis because of this pressing need and because we believe it is a strategic decision for the court to make in order to get the legislature to make the investment that is needed here without setting a precedent for this being abused in the future.
So from your perspective, anytime there is a pressing need existing within the justice system that the legislature is not adequately funding, this court has the power to raise whatever revenue is necessary to help or solve that problem.
If it is reasonably related to a regulatory objective. In this case, it's very reasonably related. That's where the solution lies. This assessment relates very closely to the regulation of the bar in two ways. First of all, it deals with a lawyer's ethical duty. All lawyers have an ethical duty to ensure access to justice for all. It's chiseled not only into courthouses, it's chiseled right into the preamble of the ethics code, SCR 20. So this fee helps lawyers discharge an ethical duty. Furthermore, lawyers directly benefit. Lawyers and their clients benefit when other litigants have lawyers.
I just have one quick follow-up. Does this money go to, I don't actually know how this money is distributed. could you just explain briefly how this money is distributed out?
Yeah, so it's governed by a Supreme Court rule, 13.01. I think 13.045 specifically talks about the distribution. It can only be used for direct legal services and only by grantees of WISDAF. So the WISDAF board, which receives funding from a lot of different sources, decides which grantees are worthy of that money, and it's only used for direct legal services. Currently, about 17 legal service organizations around the state receive about $900,000. Each of you has received the WISDAF annual report. We're happy to provide you with another copy. There's a beautiful pie chart in there that describes how the money is used. About 50% of those direct legal services help people get health services. And there are people who need those for all different reasons. Many of them are victims of domestic violence who've lost the security of their household and their household financing and need the support, for example, of Badger Care, and sometimes need to get a lawyer to be able to get those resources, and that's where the money goes.
Some of the organizations, I think, that do get some of this money have, you know, engaged in and have taken strong ideological positions.
We might call it impact litigation, right?
But also in other sorts of, you know, circumstances, whether through filing amici briefs, sometimes rule petitions as well, engaged in some of those services. Should we be concerned about some of this money going to groups that might have other potentially more political agendas?
As long as the money is being used for direct legal services, it complies with the rule that the court has set.
Yeah, that's true, but money's fungible, right? So when you give money places, it opens up money to be used for other services. So, you know, I understand accounting to at least some basic degree, and if you give grant money to organization X, to accomplish his purpose. They can, of course, itemize that, but it also frees up their budget to do other more philosophical things. Is that something that should concern us at all? I mean, one of the concerns that has happened is you tax it and give it to organizations and they're taking philosophical or political positions. That also raises an additional concern with lawyers who are potentially seen as helping to cooperate with advancing positions that they wouldn't agree with, at least indirectly.
Let me see if I can address that concern very directly by saying this. This is a very heavily regulated industry. The regulations that this court puts on $900,000 pale in comparison to the regulations and audits that these organizations face when they receive money from the Legal Services Corporation. The concerns you express are concerns that are expressed in Congress and have been imposed on the Legal Services Corporation, and these outfits have to face very careful scrutiny that they are not simply taking federal money and channeling into political kinds of objectives that would draw the ire of Congress. I would think that if you had an organization that is 90% political and 10% direct legal services and decide to make that 20% legal services so they could fund the other 80%, you might have a reason to be concerned. But I think you can look at the organizations that are all listed in the WSTAF report, many of them here, six of them are petitioners on this petition. Look carefully at the work they do and see if that draws the same concern.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's 80% activism, 20% services, but what if it's 80% services and 20% activism or 90%? Should we still be concerned with the fact that some of the organizations here do take ideological and political positions on issues? Sometimes before this court, and certainly on other things, and we are taxing attorneys to, at least in some sense, subsidize. Could be argued again with the fungibility of money, to potentially help assist that work, which I think could be concerning.
I think that concern is there if people are out to characterize their work as political work, but these are lawyers serving clients, and those amici briefs. Those actions which bring more than one defendant into a courtroom at a time are meant to serve the client who has come to them for assistance. So I'd give the benefit of the doubt to our Wisconsin lawyers who are trying to do a good job to serve their clients.
Judge, Chief, can I ask a couple of questions? Thanks for being here this morning. I have a couple of questions. I tried to group them in a logical manner, but I wasn't able to, so here goes some randomness for you. My first question has to go to, I'm just trying to wrap my mind around what exactly this money would do, and I have the overall numbers in some of the information that was sent to us regarding the number of requests for things like restraining orders that have been an increase through the years and things like that, the aggregate numbers. I'm not exactly clear. I don't know if you are able to do this, but how many people are we going to be able to help?
3,000.
Okay, so be in a calendar year. So 3,000 more Wisconsinites who aren't, and they'd get the assistance in a hearing, or they would get the assistance of legal help for the duration of a case?
Great question. So let me see if I can break that down. I come to that number 3,000 because that's the number of clients who are served by WSTAF grantees who received PILSIF funds in 2023. So WSTAF went back to its grantees, said, we gave you this money, tell us what you did with it. It could well be more than 3,000 because they didn't get responses from every one of the grantees, but they got responses from most of the grantees. And those responses said, here's the people we served, adds up to 3,000, and it's a wide variety of services. Sometimes it's right from the beginning. Person doesn't know if they've got a legal right or not. They show up at a clinic, they find out they have a legal right, and a lawyer takes the ball and runs with it. Sometimes they're people who've already filed the lawsuit on their own, find out they are drowning in a courtroom, and then they go and visit a legal services provider who helps take the ball the rest of the way. Sometimes it's not even in a courtroom. Sometimes it's in an administrative agency. Sometimes it's the cases are resolved without having to file a lawsuit.
So if we were to approve the increase that you ask for today, how many more people would be served?
We're doing it in two stages. So we're asking you to raise the assessment to $75 and then $100. So for the first 2 years of this, there'd be 50% more clients served than are currently served, 1,500. Starting in 2027, if you approve the increase of the assessment up to $100, then it would be twice as many as we currently serve. So that'd be 3,000 on top of the existing 3,000.
I am wondering how the impact of the VOCA, the Victims of Crime Act, which is something I know a lot about because I used to administer the grant when I was at the Department of Justice. In fact, I administered it for several years. I hate to say this, but I had the problem of figuring out what to do with too much VOCA money. I was there when it went from $8 million to $32 million, and I really am sincerely sorry to everyone in the room who is feeling the impact of those cuts, because I can't even imagine how difficult that is for everyone in this room and around the state. But I understand the impact those grants can have intimately. But I don't understand if you were able, and I'm not challenging you here, I'm really just trying to understand this. If you were able to help 3,000 clients last year, but now these VOCA cuts are going to, in effect, how does the base remain the same? I would think you would say we were able to do 3,000, but now we're down to 2,000 because of whatever 1,000, you know, a significant amount. And in order for us to just get up to where we are, we need the increase. What am I missing?
First of all, I hope all the justices are familiar with what Justice Kurofsky is talking about. It is a tragic situation that we face in Wisconsin. VOCA funding under the Violence of Crimes Act, was $44.5 million just a few years ago. It's $13 million now, and it's still headed downwards. And across the state, legal services organizations are laying off lawyers and narrowing their mission at a time when, of course, there's an even greater need among families in our state for these kinds of services. This money will not replace $30 million in lost funding. It will do two things. First of all, it will allow these organizations to continue to carry on their core mission, at least for 3,000 individuals, families, households. Plus, it's stable. We talk to the people who work in these organizations who do the budget. And every year, it's a balancing act. You know, VOCA funding going down. Maybe another grant will come in. We've got IOLTA funding right now based on the interest that lawyers earn on trust accounts. Right now, we're getting a lot of money from that because interest rates are high. But raise your hands. Who here would like to have our interest rates stay up? Right? Those interest rates will come down. That money will ebb and flow. So it's a constant balancing act in budgeting for these organizations to find the funds they need. The great thing about what this court did 20 years ago was to install a stable base of funding, and we hope to enlarge on that and also keep it.
I have a question, if the chief will allow.
Can I just have just more desperate
yeah.
Sandwich?
Mm-hmm.
So here's where this doesn't really follow from the other questions that I asked. We have information from the State Bar that when they asked members of the bar if they were in favor of their dues increasing, they said no. I mean, I get it, right? Like, personally, right? It's not, no offense to the State Bar, but it's not my favorite thing to do every year.
I want to ask you how you responded to the survey.
Right, yeah. and so, like, I get it, right? There'll actually be three times this week that we're going to be asked as a court for various reasons to think about the dues that we are imposing, and we're being asked to raise them for various reasons. And I get it. And I especially get it because for most of my career I've been a government lawyer, right? DA's office, I worked at the Department of Justice, I worked in the Circuit Court, work at the Supreme Court, and in all of those positions, I've had to pay my own dues. I know that for Some of our colleagues who work in larger firms, the firm pays for it. And I did work in an organization for a period of time that paid my bar dues, and that was one of my favorite benefits, even more than getting the Friday after Thanksgiving off. And so I think it's a little bit gets to what Justice Rebecca Bradley and Justice Hagedorn were getting at, a slightly different take on it. I mean, they're asking sort of like, I think, where are the guardrails here? Where does it stop from a legal standpoint? And my question is, you know, how much are we going to put on the backs of attorneys in this state? And I'm not dismissing the value of this. I mean, I could not agree with the value of the services that are being provided by these grants more. But I also do wonder, like, what are we going to do? Like, it's not like a long-term solution for you to have to file these petitions every few years and keep asking us to increase the amount that we're asking attorneys to pay. And I would say it's, in some way, it's not all attorneys. In some ways, it's government attorneys or people who own their, work in smaller firms, right? Work in nonprofit. Any attorney who's working in any of these organizations, I guarantee you that organization is not paying their bar dues.
Yeah, well, actually, one of the lawyers here is a brand new law student, and his organization, the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee, pays his.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. My daughter's about to graduate from law school in Minnesota, and this is like one of the many things she's struggling with. I think for young lawyers, it's really hard. Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. I stand corrected on that example. But I think my point isn't lost. I would just like to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay. So a few thoughts. First of all, if you want me to address the survey, I'm happy to do that. Main problem with survey, it didn't ask the question that's on your minds. Ask anybody, hey, would you like to give me more money of your money? Of course everybody's going to say no. But they didn't ask the question, would you give us more money if it was better for you and your clients and the system? On the question of whether there is a limit to how much money this court would seek to extract from lawyers, of course there's a limit. We trust your reason. $50 was as far as the court was willing to go 20 years ago, and we're only asking you to go another $50 today. $100 for those who do practice in a solo firm, for example. That's less than one half of one billable hour at the rate that lawyers on average charge in Wisconsin. For lawyers who are in government offices, who sometimes have to track their time but don't get paid a share of the profits, that's $1 a week is what they're paying right now, less than that. If you approve this, it's less than $2 a week. Now, every lawyer says, you know, I want to be careful to manage my money, and particularly at the margins. I talk to lawyers all the time about access to justice, but I talk to them in context. I talk to them about what they're already doing to help, the pro bono work they do, the direct contributions and gifts that they make to legal services organizations. And when it's addressed in that context, people say, yeah, I guess I see why we paid. And they understand, you know what, I'm doing my part. I'm helping this problem. And they don't say that $50 is too much, and I don't think they'll say $100 is too much, not when you keep it in that kind of perspective.
Do you think a $100 tax on each attorney satisfies their ethical obligation to provide pro bono legal services?
I hate to quibble with the question. That always happened in my courtroom,
too.
You
can rephrase it if you want. I'll just try again.
A $50 assessment on the lawyers is not a tax. And, no, it is not going to be too much for these lawyers to bear.
No, that's not my question. Does it satisfy their ethical obligation to provide pro bono legal services? Because my earlier questions were trying to figure out what your best argument is that would give us the power to do this. And you said, well, there's an ethical obligation on attorneys, so it relates to the regulation of the bar. And please tell me if I'm misunderstanding what your argument was. But it relates to the regulation of the bar because they have the obligation to perform, to provide pro bono legal services. But my question is, do you think that the payment of that mandatory assessment, satisfies that ethical obligation and for me need not do any more.
Thank you. And that's a really intelligent question. And so I think you'd analyze it like you would any kind of statutory construction. The lawyer's obligation to do pro bono work in SCR 20:6.1, maybe, I'm not sure exactly that's where it is, that is the exhortation of the ethical rules to do pro bono work. It is not a mandatory requirement. The mandate's in the preamble, and it's broader, to ensure equal access to justice for all. This fee is one step towards doing that, but that does not satisfy or discharge the lawyer's duty completely. And those lawyers I mentioned before, none of them have ever said to me, oh, good, I'm off the hook now. Here's another $50. Thanks for telling me about that.
But that's why I'm struggling to see how it relates to the regulation of the bar, because that there is that obligation and duty imposed on lawyers, whether we impose the assessment or not, they still have that obligation. And in my mind, the hours that attorneys donate and hours of work that they provide to people on a pro bono basis, and I think most attorneys do something pretty significant that's worth a lot more than $100. I don't see how it relates to that regulatory aspect of the bar.
The regulation of the bar requires both. It requires that they ensure access to justice broadly and specifically. It exhorts them to do pro bono. So doing one does not discharge the broader obligation, neither is the broader obligation fulfilled by paying the assessment.
Judge, let me ask you a quick question. As you can imagine, a number of attorneys have been reaching out to me about this issue, and primarily attorneys from the State Public Defender's Office and the District Attorney's Office, people that I've known over the years and people that I don't know. And I think they all, in essence, theoretically think this is a good plan, but they say to me, hey, nobody's paying my bar dues. Our bar dues, once you add all the assessments to them, are well over $500. My office isn't paying them. I'm already supplying services to impoverished people and underrepresented people. Have you thought about any exemption for particular government employees?
There is no exemption for government employees in the rule. There is a hardship waiver for people who find that's a hardship. There's a waiver for people who are in their first year of practice. They are not required to pay either. Government lawyers are not compensated as highly as people. Bigger law firms, maybe not even as highly as people in solo law firms. But they're compensated well enough to pay a dollar a week or $2 a week towards a worthy goal like this, particularly if it helps the public's trust and confidence in the system in which they operate. Those public defenders, those assistant district attorneys, are dedicated to a system of justice. And it is frustrating to lawyers to be dedicated to a system of justice that people walk away from, that people do not credit, that people will not trust. People who've been to court and have lost because the other side had a lawyer and they didn't are people who walk away not only from small claims court, not only from civil court, not only from family court. They don't have trust in those criminal courts either. So when public defenders and district attorneys pay this assessment like other lawyers do, they're contributing to the public's trust and confidence in the courts in which they operate. And I think that that is a very good return on their investment.
Can you tell us, I mean, you referred already to some of the funding besides this particular means of getting money for these services, but can you just give us a sense of what these organizations are doing on a daily basis to try to raise money to function and to provide legal services to people who can't afford them in Wisconsin?
Maybe I'll let the providers
okay.
speak. They're here. I'm using up their time.
Okay.
And they can speak from personal experience.
Yeah.
I watch carefully. I know them. I work with them. I think you'll benefit from hearing from them individually.
I just have this maybe sort of a belts and suspenders approach that you're taking here, but, you know, we've talked about this before. We've met with the Access to Justice Commission, but in my judgment, this is partly a problem. Part of it's a national problem. Part of it's a problem that we've made. You know, we make it really hard and expensive to become a lawyer. We only let lawyers perform certain kinds of legal services, and then we charge those, like a little racket we have, you know, we charge them more money so that we can exclusively provide these services. It seems to me one of the solutions is for us to lower the barriers to providing services and perhaps consider alternative ways to serve people in these situations, including by perhaps having non-lawyers be able to provide them. And the evidence seems to suggest they're just as good, if not better, than lawyers, at least in some circumstances. When I think about this problem, I think about that. I think about the problem that we've created, and now we're solving. And to me, it's like government at its worst. It's like create a monopoly, cause a problem, and then increase cost to try to fix the problem that you've caused. You know, it's why housing is, you know, expensive. So why isn't that true here? Where is the Access to Justice Commission in terms of potentially? Are there ideas on the table that we might receive that might solve this problem potentially, or at least make more meaningful progress towards this? Even if we grant what you're asking for, it is not a significant dent in this problem. We'll do probably not a lot to address it in the long term. Where are we at with solutions that will perhaps address this in a more meaningful way?
I think you're right to say belts and suspenders. I think you know from all the time we've spent together as a commission with the court that we are surveying a whole menu of options for trying to improve access to justice, and one of them is by providing services at less cost because they're not provided by lawyers. For example, benefit specialists that work for the Department of Health Services in every county in the state, providing help in navigating the healthcare finance system, just as an example. We should pursue all of those. And true, we will not solve the problem with a $50 increase in the assessment. Like I said, that's going to help 3,000 families. But remember the other number I uttered early on. There's 500,000 families and households and individuals in this state who need legal services every year that aren't getting them. 3,000 might seem like a drop in the bucket, and a pessimist would say, why even try? But you're not pessimists. You didn't take this job because of your pessimism. You took it because of your optimism, because you can make a difference. And this assessment will help make that difference for 3,000 families every year.
Well, I'm going to urge us to move forward, despite enjoying your company so very much. We have a number of other speakers to get through, and I fear that if you keep talking, they will have nothing to say at all. So why don't we move on to Ryan Billings, president of the state.
Thank you.
And we'll invite you back up at the end if there's more to add.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Billings. I'm the president of the State Bar of Wisconsin, and the State Bar appreciates the opportunity to speak at today's hearing on a very important issue where our members are both passionate and deeply divided. Let me first say, though, that there is significant common ground with petitioners, and that is there appears to be nearly universal, if not universal, agreement that civil legal aid funding is vital, imperative, and the need is urgent. This is not a question of the righteousness of the cause or the urgency of the need. It's a question of what is the appropriate funding mechanism that need. There also appears to be widespread agreement that the best body to fully meet the need for civil legal aid funding is the legislature. That is the body which has the most tools in its arsenal to address this problem. And I think if petitioners had their first choice, they would prefer full funding from the legislature. The debate here is a question of what do we do in our second best, our third best, or our fourth best option, given that historically in recent years the legislature has not funded civil legal aid and there's no tangible and certain prospect of funding in the future. But legislative aid is the only thing, civil legal aid is the only thing that's going to get us across the finish line, and for that reason the State Bar is aggressively advocating for that in this year's budget cycle. The Bar has spent a lot of time thinking about what exactly is our relation to this petition. It's not our initiative. There won't be funds under our supervision. And the answer we came to is this is something that will affect our members. So we thought it was important to get as much input and feedback as possible from our members. We issued the survey that we discussed in our letter to the court. And we also spoke with many, many members. Leadership spoke with members, our governors spoke with members in their districts and with the sections and divisions to which they are liaisons. Local bar members spoke with local bar leaders who then spoke with us, and we gathered a lot of input. I agree to some extent with petitioners that the survey is imperfect, but I think it is a fair snapshot when asked, when members are asked, what do you think is the appropriate action here? And it is also consistent with the conversations we've had. The bar is deeply divided. As far as we can tell, roughly a third, thousands of our members support the petition, if not the argument, in all material respects. I'm happy to answer any questions that relate to feedback that members have given me in support of the petition, but I wouldn't deign to try to improve on the words of Judge Sankovitz, so I will focus my time, limited as it is, on the opposition. The roughly two-thirds of our members who oppose the petition seem to gravitate to two arguments. The first is that civil legal aid is a societal need. The benefits provided by meeting that need benefit everyone. It should be borne equally by everyone in society, not disproportionately or unilaterally by attorneys.
Can I interrupt you for a second, Attorney Billings? When you say the roughly two-thirds of our members who oppose the survey, just before we get to what you're arguing, how many people are we even talking about here who actually completed the survey?
3,002, so about 17%, 1,950.
So you're talking about 17% of, you're just talking about two-thirds of 17% of your members, just so we're clear.
That is correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
Can I just ask a follow-up to that? I'm confused as to what exactly the question was. Was the question, do you want to pay more in bar dues? Or was the question, what is your feeling about civil legal aid? Like, what exactly was the question that they were asked?
That's a very good question. So we provided to our members a link to the full petition and the memorandum in support. We provided a synopsis of the arguments offered by petitioners in support and some of the arguments that have been shared to us in opposition. One of the arguments in support that we specifically included in the survey was the argument by petitioners that representation by counsel improves the efficiency of the legal system, makes case results more efficient, and is a benefit to attorneys. The question we asked was, given the information that our members were provided, do you support the petition that would increase the assessment by $25 in the fiscal year 2025 and $25 starting in fiscal year 2027. So it was very targeted at the petition, and we made every effort possible to fairly represent the arguments for and against and provide as much information as possible to our members.
And I appreciate that you did that just to follow up, but so you basically relied on people to read all the materials to actually meaningfully answer the question.
That's a fair point. I will say that 1,192 members commented, and the comments were intelligible and reflected, to me at least, that they had read the materials fairly. These are lawyers, and I trust them to do so. Obviously, not everyone would have.
Sorry, I interrupted you on what you were saying. Opposition to it is.
Bill, feel free to interrupt me anytime. So, again, a belief that this is a societal need that requires a societal response. The petitioners argue that attorneys have a special ethical. I think the court has correctly expressed concern about that kind of argument, and there's two levels to that. One is practical, one is constitutional. The practical argument is, if you're saying that attorneys have an ethical responsibility to do anything that improves access to justice or improves public support or opinion of the courts, there are a lot of things that fall under that umbrella. And I think one really easy test is replace the word civil with criminal in petitioner's memorandum. It's the same argument. So there's concern on that level. And on the constitutional level, Judge Sankovitz correctly states that the test is whether it's reasonably related to a legitimate regulatory purpose. The problem is the reasonable relations test generally applies when the court is reviewing the actions of the legislature. So it's an independent body giving an independent assessment. I should hope that the court never acts in a way that the court internally believes is unreasonable, but who is the check on that? And that's some of the concern. My time is up. I'd like to speak for a few more minutes if possible, but I see the red light.
You'd like a few more minutes. Okay. Go ahead. But if you cover something that someone else was going to cover, then they don't need to cover the same points that have already been made, just to be clear. Okay.
I will keep that in mind, and I think, based on the speaker list, I'm the only one who's going to share member views in opposition, so I'd just like to cover a few points, and then I will happily let the other speakers speak. So the second point that has been raised with us very frequently is that this will impose a hardship on certain attorneys, particularly those who serve underrepresented communities, be that by practice area or geography. I will admit that I struggled at first to wrap my head around that because from my fortunate perspective, $50 is not a lot of money. But many members came to me and said, Ryan, this is going to be a hardship to me. Please tell the court that. This matters to me. And one attorney in particular pointed out that people talk about how the cost of living is less outside of Milwaukee and Madison. Well, the cost of law school is the same. The cost of legal books is the same. The cost of legal research is the same. Legal filing fees, continuing legal education. There are a number of flat costs that attorneys in underrepresented communities have to bear, and this adds another to an already strained system.
Can I ask about the hardship exception then? I wasn't actually familiar with that Judge Stankovitz talked about. So there is, if someone felt that they couldn't pay this, they could ask to have a hardship exception?
There is a mechanism for requesting a hardship exception to dues or the assessment, and that is one potential way of resolving that concern. I would point out that that adds another burden to seek the exception to those who are paying the assessment. And if you make everyone pay it and many, many have to apply for the exception, that adds an administrative cost and a burden.
Has that been an issue so far? This has been in place for 20 years. Have you gotten a lot of people saying they can't pay it?
Under the current assessment, it has not been overwhelming.
Thank you.
Why not just let people opt in to pay instead of work to get out of paying?
That is another option. And I would point out that a lot of our members noted that attorneys are very generous with their time and their money in many, many different ways, some of them directly related to the law, some otherwise. And many members believe that if you give that option, you might get more money from attorneys who are giving it voluntarily rather than a forced basis. So the last thing I just want to share is that one of the alternatives that was expressed to us is potentially to temper the increase, to spread it out over more years, perhaps 5 or 10, to ease the burden on lawyers a little bit. And we can get into a complicated debate about how much money WSTAF has or how much $50 is worth today versus 2005. Interest rates are high, as Justice Stankovitz admitted, and WSTAF recently issued a report indicating that the amount of grants it's been able to give to civil legal aid have increased exponentially in recent years. Between 2016 and 2022, it was roughly $500,000 in aggregate a year. In 2023, it was over $2 million. In 2024, it was over $3 million. So yes, $50 today is worth 80% of what it was 10 years ago, but the amount of grants that WSTAF has been able to give for many reasons has increased by a factor of 6. So perhaps we have that room to temper the increase and ease the burden on attorneys. If there are no questions, I will thank the court for
one more. Did the State Bar use a survey methodology that gives the State Bar confidence that the sample produced is representative of the State Bar's members?
That's a great question. And so one of the initial questions we asked is, should we hire a third party to make sure it's statistically representative and of what groups? And my assessment was, I don't want to spend our members' funds spending tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars doing that.
Your members probably thank you for that.
I hope so. But 3,000 people responded, and petitioners say that's a 17% response rate. And I say that's a 17% response rate, which those who have engaged in the political process, it's hard to get people to respond on just about anything. And we gave up members an opportunity to speak to us orally in many different outlets. We think it's fair to say that while it may not be exactly two-thirds, and one of our governors eloquently said that you can discount the survey results to some degree, but you can't dismiss them. It's clear that there's a majority in opposition to the petition.
Can you put a little more meat on the bones of what you mean by temper?
So, for instance, rather than doing $25 this fiscal year and then $25 in 2027, it could be $5 a year or $10 a year until we get to that mark. That's an alternative that was presented to us, and it would ease the burden on attorneys, especially those who are serving underrepresented communities. That's an option that the court has to consider.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Next is James Gremling, Board of Directors of the Wisconsin Justice Initiative. There's your hat you're wearing today.
Chief Justice Ziegler, members of the court, I'm Jim Gremling. I'm a board member of the Wisconsin Justice Initiative, And our goals for our organization include trying to make the justice system a fairer environment for low-income people. I prepared some remarks today that I think have become irrelevant. I wanted to encourage you to believe even stronger than you do in the merit of the work that's being done by the legal aid organizations in the state. I can tell from some of the comments made that there's an assumption on your part, a belief on your part, that that is the case. So I'm not going to go into my specific examples that largely involve work I've done. My first job as a lawyer was as a legal aid lawyer, and I did that for 15 years. So I had the experience of being in the trenches, doing that work day in, day out for 15 years. I moved on from there to become a judge in Milwaukee Municipal Court. And you may not equate that necessarily with legal aid work, but believe me, there was a lot of effort that had to be made to make sure that people didn't get ground up in the system. I was aided in my work there by a legal aid lawyer who one day appeared in court from the Legal Aid Society and asked me in a motion to appoint a guardian ad litem. And the municipal courts are very informal, and there was no guardian ad litem status. There's nothing in the statutes, nothing in the practice. The city said I didn't have the authority to do it. I was pretty new to the bench, and I thought, well, what do I do now? The legal aid lawyer convinced me that I had the authority, so I appointed a guardian ad litem for a gentleman who was incompetent. I think everybody had agreed, but it was just, could I do it? And it was that legal aid lawyer that convinced me I could, and the city appealed to the circuit court, and Judge Mike Barron and the Milwaukee County Circuit Court said, well, Gramling, not only does he have the authority to do it, but he must do it in order to provide for fairness in that level of the court system. I wouldn't even have thought about the issue and acted on it except for the advocacy of a legal aid lawyer who appeared before me and brought that to my attention and pursued the matter further up the level. So I'm going to refrain from going much further and getting into specific examples of where I found that my work in the legal aid field was a great benefit to our fellow citizens of lesser means.
I have a question.
Yes.
Good to see you, by the way.
Very good to see you, Justice. I'm sorry that I won't see you further in this. But.
And when I say it's been a while, Paul, in around 2016, you were filing with this court a request for a Ledge Council study. Do you have at least some recollection of that? And the court discussed this in the Ledge Council study to determine and to assess legal services and access to justice. And the court considered that, and then Chief Justice Pat Rogensack wrote a letter on behalf of the court and all the justices asking for a Ledge Council report on the study of access to civil legal services. So we got that report, and there was a recommendation for three pieces of legislation that came out of the Joint Legislative Council's report. As I recall, they passed the legislature, didn't pass the Senate, didn't go any further, and ultimately the request was just, you know, we ended up dismissing, having done what we could, the request or the petition that was before us. Is there any merit, or think about this, you don't have to have an answer today, is there any merit to asking for a Legislative Council report at all? You know, it seems to me that to have a Joint Legislative Council report may give added impetus to the members of the legislature when they look at and rely on
what the Ledge Council has done? Or is that just more work with little potential results?
In a perfect world, Justice, I think it would be a marvelous route to take. I've had my own experience with the court recently with regard to interpreters in municipal court, and the court invited the council to look into this and see if there wasn't a solution that could be obtained other than through a rule change. And the council's dealing with it now.
And that's the judicial
I'm
council.
Sorry, did I? Maybe I misspoke on,
no, no,
in
no,
terms
no,
of which
sorry.
Council.
The judicial
but,
council.
Yeah, but the Ledge Council. Yeah. I've had some experience with the council, and I think that their participation can provide some general support and validity to efforts that are made to change some elements of what exists. So I would not overlook that as a possibility.
Okay. Thank you.
Seeing a red light, I'm just going to finish by saying that after I retired, I had an opportunity to continue doing legal aid work on a pro bono basis, and I can speak to the way in which it makes lawyers feel better that they're contributing even beyond their active work. And there are still many things that can be done. The pro bono efforts that are made by members of the State Bar are huge, but they're not enough to address the need. And so any effort that can be made to improve things, of course, with the finances that enable these organizations to hire lawyers and provide a broader service would be welcome. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you this morning.
Thank you. Next, we have Connor. Is it Garrell? Great. Marquette University Law School Juris Doctor Candidate Class of 2025.
Good morning, Your Honors, and thank you for your time. As was just alluded to, my name is Connor Garrell. I am a current Marquette University Law student. I will also keep this brief. You know, it is hard to live up to the expectations that have already been spoken on by some incredible people in this room, as well as those who are going to follow me. I am still a student, but I will graciously be back here in a few months to be sworn in with the next wave of Wisconsin attorneys. And I'm honored and humbled to join the legal community in sharing the responsibility that we are discussing today. In my short yet formative time as a law student, I've had the incredible opportunities to intern with the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee, Legal Action Wisconsin, and Equal Justice Works. In doing so, I have seen firsthand the desperate need for public interest work in the state and the profound impact it has on so many. For example, just last month, our team at Legal Aid, of three attorneys and one intern, were able to host a comprehensive estate planning clinic for over 40 low-income elderly citizens in Milwaukee. This amazing event culminated with us completing estate documents for nearly 20 of these individuals who would otherwise have lost property and generational equity without our service. Yet despite the work we did that day, we were not able to help everyone who came to that event seeking our service, and we're returning three more times this year alone just in hopes of reaching everyone in that community with this kind of work. So while the supply of advocacy in this space does not yet reach the demand, we can significantly bridge that gap with the solution before you today. After all, I invite you to all remember your first days as law students. From the very beginning, we are taught that our calling is a helping profession. It is about service to our communities and to society as a whole. It is about justice and due process, not just for those who have the means to afford our services, but for everyone. Now, $50 is certainly no negligible amount, but in the grand scheme of things, it truly is a fraction of a single billable hour for any charging attorney in the state. In this context, this nominal amount will create extraordinary results for thousands of citizens in Wisconsin, especially the most vulnerable. That kind of positive impact of this petition will reach far beyond the financial value of the assessment itself. Thank you for your time and allowing me the opportunity to comment on this proposed rule. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I will reserve the time for all the great speakers who are to follow.
Mr. Garrell, I cannot think of a time in our history when we need good attorneys. We need good attorneys now more than ever. I am so happy you decided to go to law school. Your family and your friends must be so proud of you. And to think that certainly at least the way you are starting off your career representing some of the most vulnerable people in our state is beyond commendable as far as I'm concerned. So congratulations on all you have already done. I'm going to keep your name in mind because I want to see what you do after you graduate this spring, and I look forward to seeing you in May or June whenever we're doing your swearing-in ceremony.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I certainly wouldn't be here without a lot of the wonderful people behind us and our petitioners on this very petition giving me these opportunities and supporting me along the way. So I appreciate that very much, and I hope to see you all again in the future.
We hope to see you, too. Also, consider some of the legal deserts in the state of Wisconsin where we have lawyers, zero lawyers that judges can appoint to cases. No lawyers. Those people have zero possibility of representation. So consider it and tell all your friends. Thank you. You've made your first argument before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and you haven't graduated yet.
Right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Next is Judge Domina, Waukesha County.
May it please the court. Good morning. I am Bill Domina, Waukesha County Circuit Court, Branch 11. It's my pleasure to be here today, and I will be brief. I woke up this morning feeling as though I was being asked to present today because I'm wise.
Oh, well. I don't want to disabuse you.
No, that's okay. After the recantation of history, much of which I participated in, I feel as I was asked because I'm old. This is my 15th year of being a judge in the state of Wisconsin, and my 40th year of being a member of the Wisconsin Bar Association. Over 20 years ago, on the Board of Governors meetings on this issue, as a representative, as the president of the government lawyers, I argued in opposition to the establishment of the fee that was ultimately adopted by this court. Now, that's not the first time in my career that my brilliance and wisdom were not recognized. Since that time, and at that time, when I was an advocate for a group, and I have sensitivity to that group, I have sensitivity to small and solo practitioners, having been married to one for almost 40 years. I've also had the experiences of being a judge. So I'm not here today as an advocate, because I'm limited in my ability to advocate by Supreme Court rule for judges. I'm here today to observe. Our courts are different. I started in 2010. And I observe that there is an increase in density. There is an increase in the self-represented. And there is an increase, in my view, in the struggle of the judges in our courts to address this and deal with it fairly. And it comes in all shapes and subjects. I've been through every division in Waukesha County. The unrepresented appear in civil, in family, in criminal. And in my observation, we address that mostly in our criminal cases. Not fully, and you know there's struggle there across the state, but in our family, in our civil cases, the unrepresented who appear because they are too poor to afford an attorney, have impact on our court process. And sometimes place judges in the position when they're attempting to do justice or to provide equity, as family courts are also courts of equity, where they slip into the position of becoming advocates for individuals that appear before them. And you can imagine that that's not, or that is a dangerous moment relative to our ability to serve objectively in cases. So I come to really reinforce the fact that despite the arguments, the fee that was established over 20 years ago has existed. I pay it. And I believe that the costs related to the administration of justice have increased over that 20 years, not a statement of brilliance. I graduated from law school in 1985 with a $5,000 debt, mainly because I bought a computer and a Betamax player from American TV. My daughter graduated in 2016. I don't even want to tell you the amount of student debt she has. Costs have increased. I was privileged to serve on WISTAF's board as the appointee of Justice Rogensack. You, Justice Ziegler, appoint representatives. I know you know this, but I'm speaking to the group. And that representation is important. It was formational for me. I visited the providers, the individuals receiving the grants, not the individuals, the organizations. We were all assigned organizations to review. I can recall a visit to La Causa in Milwaukee and to Catholic Charities in Milwaukee to bear witness to how they were utilizing the money. I did not walk away cynical or uncertain as to whether or not their activities somehow were co-opted by the provision of really very de minimis grant amounts that they were helping a lot of people with. So I stand before you as a trial judge who believes that we need to do things in our system to help our system, and this is but one. And so today, after that length of service, I'm asking you to strongly consider the fact that costs have increased over time, and our costs will as well. I thank you for your time. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I will stand silent, which is always invited.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Judge. All right. Mike Rust, COO of ABC for Rural Health, Inc.
Good morning. As you stated, my name is Mike Rust. I work for ABC for Rural Health out of Polk County, Wisconsin. As is perhaps appropriate, as a representative of one of the legal deserts, I'm not an attorney. I am a health benefits counselor with ABC for Rural Health and connected to civil legal services through the attorneys at our main office at ABC for Health in Madison. The way that I got my position as a family health benefits counselor with what at the time was the Center for Public Representation is somewhat pertinent to the hearing today. And I realized that you've not talked as though you need to be persuaded about the value of the service, that you have other issues. Nonetheless, it seems I was asked here to try to describe to you how these civil legal services dollars have made their ways into the lives of hundreds and even now a few thousand people in rural northern and western Wisconsin. Back in 1985, the Center for Public Representation and two enterprising public health directors in Polk and Barron counties came up with a summer legal internship project. The project brought two legal interns, one of whom was Bobby Peterson, now the executive director at ABC for Health, up to Polk and Barron counties where they interviewed families who were facing formal collection actions for medical debt. What they found in their interviews with families was that many of the families could have been eligible for Medicaid and avoided their debt at all. but had no idea that the program was available to them. Others were represented by private insurance companies that did not pay claims that they should have paid at the time. Another thing that was common with most of these families is that almost none of them, I don't know the exact number, but almost none of them were represented by a lawyer. Here they were, facing a moment that would have grave consequences on their lives, but they didn't have a lawyer. And so the public health directors and the Center for Public Representation came up with the idea of creating the position of family health benefits counseling. They secured funding. I got wind of the job and sold my home in bright and sunny East Cleveland, Ohio, and came to rural Wisconsin to work for the Center for Public Representation. Yeah, it is kind of funny, isn't it?
What part of Cleveland? I'm from Cleveland.
Oh, okay, great.
Go ahead.
So still most of the people that I work with, and I work with about 300 to 400 families a year, almost none of them have the means or the resources to actually hire an attorney. They're facing actions that are going to have grave consequences on their lives. They've been denied Badger Care, denied Medicaid. It's outside the open enrollment period for the federal marketplace. And they found out they have a dread disease or they got injured. So they need someone to help them navigate through that terrain to find a way to get their medical care paid for. The attorneys at ABC for Health touch every case that I work on. We meet twice every day at brief stand-up meetings. We meet for a more extended time on Wednesday mornings for a case meeting. And the attorneys make sure that the proper rules are being applied in every case. If I have to write a complaint for a No Surprises Act or for some other action to prepare someone a preparatory statement for their or an introductory statement for a hearing, the lawyers at ABC make sure that the proper rules and laws are cited appropriately, that the arguments are made clearly and concisely and powerfully, and it's been very, very effective. So much so that now on our Friday agency meetings, we set aside time at the end to do nothing but bring up the victories we had that week. And it takes us usually about 15 minutes just to go through and list them, which means there's a lot that can be done. Just a couple of cases that show the impact not only on people's lives, but on hospital systems getting paid. A client is a seasonal worker, works in the summertime, not in the wintertime. Not insured, living on his unemployment check. Found out he has a condition that needs to have major surgery, no insurance, calls me outside the marketplace open enrollment. He had already applied for Badger Care and been denied because his monthly check was too high for Badger Care. So when we're talking about it afterwards, he says casually, yeah, and my boss says that he's not going to open the paving company back up again this spring. So he didn't have a job to go back to. Boom. Opens the door to the obscure gap filler program. Somebody whose annual income is too low for the marketplace tax credits, but too high monthly income for Badger Care. We called the consortium back. Half an hour later, he's covered. He calls me about 2 months later and says, Mike, you saved me $500,000. Of course, the hospital, since it was Badger Care, didn't get paid $500,000, but they got paid. Another client had been in a northern county, was the victim of a hit-and-run accident. He'd been trying for several years to get his uninsured motorist policy to pay for it. They wouldn't. It's now 4 years later, and a community clinic puts him in touch with me. What we discovered is that he had applied for Badger Care after the accident, but nobody had ever pursued BadgerCare paying for it. As a matter of fact, BadgerCare wasn't backdated to the date of the accident and the hospitalization at the time. Now, 4 years ago. Well, there's a strange clause in BadgerCare and Medicaid in Wisconsin, which is that you can request a backdate at any time. Well, that's what we did. 4 years later, requested a backdate. It was granted. We were able to use late claims billing procedures, and he was relieved of the debt, and the hospital got paid. So I think my time is up, but I thank the members of the court for the opportunity to be here today. And I urge approval of the petition. Thank you.
Thank you for your good work. Lorene Laman, co-chair, Wisconsin Elder Justice Coalition.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I come before you today as the co-chair of the Wisconsin Elder Justice Coalition and as a retired special agent with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, Division of Criminal Investigation, where I spent a good part of my career specializing in the investigation of elder financial exploitation. I have sat with countless elderly victims who, after a lifetime of hard work and savings, found themselves targeted, deceived, and stripped of their financial security. These are not just statistics. They are our neighbors, our parents, our grandparents, and our friends. Men and women who built this state and now, in their most vulnerable years, found themselves defenseless against sophisticated fraud and predatory financial abuse. Justice is only justice if it is accessible. The unfortunate reality is that for many of our elderly victims of financial exploitation, justice is out of reach. Without proper legal representation, they lose their homes, their savings, and in some cases, their ability to live independently. The proposed increase to the assessment is not just a procedural change. It is a lifeline for the elderly individuals our coalition is dedicated to protecting. I have seen firsthand how civil legal aid is often the only defense against financial predators. When an elderly victim is coerced into signing over their property, when their caretakers siphon retirement savings, or when they are misled into scams disguised as legitimate investments, law enforcement can only do so much. Legal intervention is critical. It is what halts evictions and foreclosures, reverses fraudulent financial transactions, repairs credit, and sometimes restores stolen assets. My investigations revealed the staggering losses suffered by this underserved population, sometimes $75,000 or $100,000, and in some cases as much as $1 million. These were not just numbers on a report. They represented stolen homes, depleted life savings, and most devastatingly, the loss of an already vulnerable adult's sense of safety and security. Several times a week, I received calls from investigators and advocates seeking assistance with cases involving losses of $2,500, $900, sometimes only $500. Each time, I was forced to explain that the loss did not rise to the level needed for me to do much more than provide guidance. Too often, the nature of these crimes required specialized expertise and training, as they are too complex, too convoluted, and too time-consuming for local law enforcement, who, like DCI special agents, are stretched thin. Rather than leaving victims with nowhere to turn, we must be able to refer them to legal aid resources to try to get them some relief through the civil system. Without legal aid advocates, victims are left to navigate a complicated system that was not adequately designed to protect them from predators who exploit their trust and financial vulnerabilities. Today, the demand for legal services far outweighs the resources available, including to older adults. In Wisconsin, our elderly population is growing, and with it, crime. Between 2001 and 2019, that's 18 years, financial elder abuse reports increased over 300%. They continue to grow. What happens to our victims when they can't find legal assistance, when they can no longer afford to feed themselves, pay their mortgages, or buy medication? When they are evicted, often they must turn to state-funded programs and housing. Should the burden of supporting legal services for our most vulnerable fall solely on the shoulders of our esteemed attorneys? Of course not. But we are only talking about $50. I stand before you today not as a paid advocate, but as a retired investigator, volunteering both my time and my money because this issue matters. From the vehicle and the gas I used to get here last night to the hotel and the dinner I had and the lunch I might grab on the way home, all of this was my own funding. Every expense has been mine because protecting our elderly and low-income residents is not the responsibility of one group alone. It is a duty we share as a community. The Elder Justice Coalition stands in strong support of Petition 2405 because we understand what is at stake. This is about whether victims will have an attorney to stand up for them in court to defend them against unjust eviction, fraud, and coercion. It is about ensuring our justice system works for everyone, not just those who can afford to navigate it. I urge this court to recognize the critical role legal aid plays in protecting Wisconsin's elderly and other vulnerable populations and to approve Petition 24-05. Let's not wait until more seniors lose their homes, their dignity, and their hard-earned security to act. Let us stand on the right side of justice, ensuring that those who spent their lives contributing to this state are not left defenseless in their most vulnerable years. Thank you for your time and your commitment to justice for all.
Thank you very much. Perfect timing, actually. Your light just went on. You are the first one today, and you get an extra gold star for that.
You get her a free lunch for that.
Yep. Yeah. Justice Kurofsky wants to buy you lunch.
I will be happy to. I hope you treat yourself at least to a nice lunch. That was,
all right.
I heard you.
Deb Patsky, Judicare and Legal Action, volunteer.
Good morning. Thank you for your time. I volunteer for, I started out volunteering for Judicare. I live in Neenah at the time, and I drove to Wausau, 102 miles one way. That sounds crazy to perhaps you, but.
It's almost like my commute.
Yeah.
Well,
but it was worth
2
it.
2 hours and 20 minutes to Wausau.
Well, I mean, it was worth it because of the people I worked with when I got there. And I was actually offered a job with after I retired. I was offered a job with Judicare, and I said, I'd rather volunteer because that way I won't have to go to meetings if I don't want to. And really, I had enough. But meetings are important too, so I don't want to diminish that. But I started out doing, and I'll just be very brief if I can. Started with landlord-tenant issues, and with the help of Beth Ann Richland, who I think is one of the foremost experts in landlord-tenant issues in the state of Wisconsin. And I was able to get evictions dismissed, which, I thought was pretty good. But again, I couldn't have done it without help, or without guidance. And it was an elderly woman, an elderly man, and a young couple with a child. And none of those people had anywhere to go if they'd been evicted. There were a couple student loans. The situation has changed, but there were a couple student loans that I was able to get dismissed. People with disabilities had nowhere to go, and I was able to help them, again, with help from Judicare. But one of the issues... you mentioned, Judge Bradley, that you didn't have the money and weren't able to access legal aid. In my experience, one of the issues with that I see, that you obviously don't have, is there are a lot of people with untreated mental health issues. And I know I'm not a mental health expert. But as an attorney, I can refer clients to services that can help these people. And when they get a call from an attorney, it makes a difference. I mean, we have status, and I know we're picked on a lot too, but we do have status, and it makes a difference. I mean, I recently had a case. There was a client who thought it was a CHIPS petition up in Wausau, but it wasn't. It didn't turn out to be. But I was able to listen in on the meeting that they had with the child and her caregivers. And just listening in, just my presence, I think made a difference because, again, this person has an attorney. We better, make sure we're minding our P's and Q's. One of the other things I did was a truancy court at Appleton West High School because, I'm much shorter commute. I sat in. Somebody asked me if I wanted to do it, and I sat in for one of the sessions. And I thought, oh, God, yeah, I need to be here because these kids really need some help. And I think, you know, just the support, just the presence, just being seen, just that somebody's listening to them makes a difference. I mean, when I was doing unemployment insurance hearings, I had one woman come in, and there was no opposition. And I said, you know, you've won. You don't have to worry. You don't have to tell me all these things. And she said, no, damn it. I want somebody to listen to me, and you're going to listen to me because nobody else will. And I find that a lot true a lot of the people that I assist. So, I mean, just to kind of bring this together, if I can, you know, I mean, I think the question is, okay, there is a system now that lawyers are paid for, or not lawyers, I'm sorry, there's funding for legal aid provided by the state bar. So does it work? And I've never heard anybody say it doesn't work. So then the question becomes, well, is it something that should be expanded? Because with inflation, what affects everybody, the money that was originally appropriated 20 years ago doesn't go as far today. So then I think the question becomes, well, is it a priority or is it an obligation? And for me, it's a priority. For some, it might be an obligation, and an obligation seems more like a burden and more distasteful. But if the system is working, and we all know that federal funds aren't what they used to be, and especially with COVID funding lapsing now as it should, there's just a great need, and the need, the state bar has an opportunity to fulfill that need. Now, maybe you don't think that's the state bar's role, but there is a need to be, I see I'm getting a red light. So there is a need that needs to be filled. So, and real quickly too, somebody talked about providing, I forget which judge it was, I apologize, talked about, you know, why can't non-lawyers do this? Well, they can, but I can tell you in my experience with mediation that involved non-lawyers at times, you know, there's a reason we're lawyers. I mean, honestly, I couldn't do that anymore. I mean, because it wasn't consistent with how the legal system should be working, even if it's meant to help take a burden off the courts. So anyway, I've gone over my time. One last thing. I know this is indulging, but you mentioned legal desert in Wisconsin. I know the state bar for years has been trying to provide services up north, or try to get more attorneys up north and with bus tours and everything else. And now somebody, it usually comes down to money, and somebody did recently was kind enough to contribute a bunch of money to provide more financial incentive to get lawyers up there. But I would mention, Attorney Kaiser in his letter said, many of my clients have problems outside my area of expertise. In those cases, services offered by Judicare Legal. They just come to the rescue more times than I can count. And that's true of legal action in Wisconsin, too, where I do felony pardon applications. I didn't really talk about legal action enough, but I've gone way over my time as it is. So one way to get more legal representation up north is through legal aid. It just is. It's a practical alternative to finding a way to get attorneys up there. But the reason attorneys aren't up there is because there's not a lot of money up there, and it often comes down to money. And it's really hard to make a living as an attorney in many parts of rural northern Wisconsin, or rural Wisconsin, period, in my experience. So I would just suggest that's one possible solution to the problem. Thank you for your indulgence. Any questions?
Thank you for your good work.
I'm happy to do it.
Angela Medcalf, staff attorney at Legal Services Program at Bivens Health.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Angela Medcalf, and I am a May 2024 graduate of Marquette University Law School. I stand before you today in strong support of Petition 24-05, and I'd like to take a brief moment to share with you a personal connection I have with civil legal. During my junior year of college, I decided to pursue a minor in family financial planning. Now, at this time, I already knew that I wanted to attend law school, but it wasn't until I completed this coursework that I decided that I wanted to devote my legal practice to trust and estates work. Now, these courses were self-guided, and then oftentimes we had little to no instructor assistance, And at the conclusion of my studies, I reflected on three key thoughts. First, I realized that everyone needs an estate plan regardless of their financial status. Second, I recognized that it must be very difficult to conceptualize what an estate plan is and the importance of it, not just for yourself, but also for your families and the generations that may come behind you. And lastly, I envision creating my own nonprofit one day dedicated to providing estate planning and financial planning services to those who cannot afford them. It was then that I made a commitment to center my legal practice around estate planning and to focus on serving communities that face significant barriers to obtaining legal assistance. Now, at this time, I hadn't necessarily decided on which law school I wanted to go to, and outside of diploma privilege being offered here in Wisconsin, Marquette University had an estate planning clinic and also the Wills for Veterans Clinic, and that really spoke to me. Admittedly, my first step after graduation wasn't to work at a nonprofit. For a short period of time, I did work at a law firm where I did estate planning work, and while I enjoyed the work that I was doing, I felt that I wasn't meeting the target community with my work. So fast forward to today, I am now proud to serve as a staff attorney with the Civil Legal Aid Organization in Milwaukee, where we primarily focus on providing estate planning services to persons living with HIV. None of the individuals that walk into our offices can afford the hourly rates or the flat fees traditionally charged by firms when preparing estate planning documents, yet the need for these services is especially urgent. And thanks to the Public Interest Legal Services Fund, my organization and many others are able to provide these essential services to those who need them most. The proposed increase in the annual assessment is long overdue, and it should not be viewed as a burden or a significant demand, but rather a call to action to strengthen our support for the communities where we practice. Most of the lawyers that I know enter this profession with the goal of making a difference in the world. And what better way to do that than by supporting organizations that directly impact the communities in which we serve. I am personally willing to support this increase because I fully understand the tremendous value of the Public Interest Legal Services Fund and what it brings to individuals and communities who would otherwise be denied access to crucial legal services. Thank you for your time and consideration, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your good work as well. Wow, we're making Marquette proud today, I think. Look at these young lawyers. Amazing. All right, we're at the end of the list of people who signed up. As I promised in the beginning, we'd open it up for anyone in the audience who may want to come up and speak, who may not have necessarily gotten their name in this morning. Okay, we have Dean Dietrich. And I would say, with all of this, we'll try to wrap it up by 11:30 because they need to start to get the courtroom ready for admissions that occur at noon. It takes about a half an hour to get it set up for that. So we are kind of under a bit of a timeline this morning. But
thank you. May it please the court. I ask you today to look at me as an old lawyer, not someone related to the State Bar of Wisconsin. I do not come here today to speak on behalf of the State Bar of Wisconsin. I have had the privilege over my career to help lawyers understand their obligations under the rules of professional conduct. And I'd like to answer the question that you posed, Justice, regarding the monetary contribution and whether that monetary contribution would meet the requirements of the rules of professional conduct. Then my answer would be no, but. And it's no because I don't think that it meets the intent or the content of the rule, 20:6.1, which talks about pro bono service. But 20:6.1 is not a mandatory rule. It is a voluntary rule. It is an encouragement rule. It is a rule that says lawyers should. It doesn't say lawyers must. So if a lawyer came to me and said, I'm giving this contribution, does that satisfy my ethical duties and I won't be prosecuted by the Office of Lawyer Regulation? My response is no. I don't think that the money contribution meets that test, but I also don't think that you will be prosecuted by the Office of Lawyer Regulation because it is a discretionary rule, not a rule that makes a requirement. As I said, I'm an old lawyer. I like to think I'm an old country lawyer, but I think I'd be fooling some people with that. Obviously, this is a critical issue of import to the court system, to the rule of law, to civil justice. There is a party that has not been willing to come to the table. My belief is that this court should find, perhaps, that there is a basis for a small increase in the court and a court-ordered assessment, but also find that the court will authorize a further assessment down the road, several years, provided the legislature matches all of the contribution that is made by the lawyers as part of this assessment. I don't like the business of using threats of funding or not funding as a way to accomplish a task. But perhaps I might rather submit, because of 20 years of very, very limited involvement by the legislature, the court needs to put a statement together that says this additional amount will be assessed, but only if the full amount of what the lawyers contribute is matched by the legislature. Let's start making people come to grips with the issue. Thank you for the opportunity to present my comments to you.
Interesting. Thank you.
Counselor, how's that? You've been around the bar for quite some time, and there's was a comment about opting in. On the dues statement now, I think there is a opt-in, that is a voluntary contribution, if I recall, to the Wisconsin Law Foundation.
Correct.
Which does good work in assisting the administration of justice and programs like we have here. Do you have any knowledge about how successful that opt-in contribution to the Wisconsin Law Foundation is? In other words, what's the revenue? Do you have any knowledge regarding that?
As treasurer of the Wisconsin Law Foundation, I should have more knowledge than I have.
Well, I think I asked the right person.
I do know that the opt-in provision is used by lawyers. I also know that a vast majority, I don't have percentages, but the vast majority of the due statements are filled out by legal assistants or finance directors for law firms, and that opt-in is not made readily available or knowledgeable for most lawyers. They have to sign the form, but they sign the form after it's filled out, and they just look to where they put their signature. So I don't think it has been as successful as we would have hoped it was. I might also, if I may, pardon me for being presumptive, but it would present a great deal of confusion if we have two opt-out provisions on our due statement. That, I think, would be very unfortunate for both parties.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone else like to be heard before I turn it over to Judge Sankovic? If you have any closing remarks.
Before you start, I didn't ask anyone else of the question that I had at the beginning because I didn't feel like, I didn't know if anyone really had the answer. So my question, if you remember, Judge Sankovic, was what are the kinds of things that organizations are doing to, like, are you just coming to us, or what else is going on here behind the scenes to try to get money for civil legal aid in Wisconsin? I felt like each one was kind of just a little tiny piece, so I don't know if you can address my question or if someone else in the audience can.
I think the question, just to make sure I understand it, is what is the campaign? to try to solve this problem.
Right, right. It can't just be asking us for 25 and 25.
No. $900,000 is not going to do it. The campaign is to tap every source that we can, and the legislature is the main target of that campaign, because the legislature is the one with the ability to make the investment that's needed here. That's what happens in states that are successful. So look at two states that are successful, Minnesota, Texas. In Minnesota and Texas, it's a combination of efforts. It's a partnership of courts, the bar, and the legislature in those three states to raise the millions of dollars needed to address this subject. That is an orchestrated campaign we do every year. We're tuning up to do it again this year. One thing that we think will make us more successful in what we do, in addition to all the efforts the state bar is making this year, is to go to the legislature and say, the court and the bar keep stepping up. Now the legislature should step up too. Does that help?
Yes, thanks. What about Cypre? Are you getting class action funds at all?
Great question. For the non-English speakers, Cypre is the doctrine we use when there's a class action to take the leftover funds that are not redeemed by members of the class and pay that to WSTAF. There's a rule that the court adopted on the petition of the Wisconsin Access to Justice Commission that says that a circuit judge should put the first 50% into WSTAF and has the option to put the rest of it there too. We've had some banner years. $600,000 left in one class action, $300,000 of it went to WSTAF. We've had some years that have been kind of dry. It's not the stable funding that Justice Kurofsky and I were talking about that's needed, particularly with the dire circumstances we're in now. So here's some brief comments. Look at the evidence before you. Is there evidence of great opposition to this fee? No. Two-thirds of 17% of the bar oppose it, but 83% of the bar was not even troubled to respond. I think that's evidence that this is not troubling to the bar. Lawyers don't seek hardship exemptions. They don't consider it a hardship. I think that's evidence that this is not too much to ask. This question of whether we should phase this in more slowly is an evidentiary weighing question for the court. Weigh the evidence of how little opposition there is against how dire the need is, particularly now with the loss of VOCA and so many other funding streams. There is evidence about whether a voluntary checkoff would work. It doesn't. Arizona is a state that has a voluntary checkoff. It raises about $125,000 to $150,000 a year in a bar that is bigger than our bar, also a mandatory bar. Nowhere near the $900,000 we get from our checkoff. Is there any evidence that making contributions mandatory will deter people from making voluntary contributions? That argument was made 20 years ago. No evidence that voluntary contributions have been deterred as a result. I love the Chief Justice's comments at the Judicial Convention, and I like the fact that we're continuing to press that issue. One thing that I think is worthy of pointing out here is Judicare, the legal services organization that serves the northern 33 counties of the state, sometimes is the only lawyer available. And that's an organization that benefits greatly if the court supports this assessment. Finally, some inspiration for you. We met two law students. They're the future of this profession. But they're not the first law students who appeared here. Ethan Richland is over here. She's the executive director of Judicare. She was a law student in this hearing room in 2005. At the time the court approved this petition and approved this assessment. What the court does here makes a difference to the work of other lawyers who are inspired by what the court does to take seriously our duty to ensure access to justice for all. Justice Hagedorn's comment about barriers to entry might be a justification for getting lawyers to pay. Hey, this is a privilege. Because we put this monopoly on you and have raised these barriers to entry, that has caused externalities that have fallen on people who can't afford the services, so maybe lawyers should pay to solve those externalities. I can see that equation, and that might be a justification. I think there are stronger justifications, and I think there's more political justifications. Lawyers benefit in a way that they should share some of their benefits and contribute to this fund, and I think that's a better way to appeal to them, to say, we're going to punish you for being part of a monopoly and being a beneficiary of these high barriers to entry. I'll close with this note of gratitude. 20 years of this assessment have made the difference in tens of thousands of lives in the state. Not only clients, not only lawyers, not only judges like I, whose courtrooms now have lawyers in them instead of having to have people who are unguided trying to navigate through them. That is a great accomplishment. The court needs to make sure it doesn't allow it to wither on the vine. Now is the time to take up this assessment. Make today a landmark day, a day that we can look back on and say, yes, we're doing our part to broaden access to justice. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you everyone who attended today, to whether you were here to take it all in. We appreciate you coming. We also appreciate, I can tell you, there's no question this court appreciates the good work being done by all of these organizations and the people out there fighting for justice every single day. So thank you for that. We will adjourn. We will reconvene at 1:30 in open administrative conference.